Truck Audio Tales.
Brought to you by BunnySlippers.com. Check out their brand new Dino Sound Slippers. Slippers make a roaring sound every 3 steps. Made with green scaly fabric, soft plush uppers, foam footbeds, non-slip grips on soles, and 3 white claws on each foot. One size fits most, up to women's 10.5, men's 9. Footbed measures 10.5. Black Clock Audio Tales is a daily podcast that reads you a story, either a chapter of a novel or a whole short story. Join us in our exploration of old ghost stories, supernatural fiction, horror tales, folk tales, fantasy, gothic horror, weird fiction, and cosmic horror. And don't forget to join us for our monthly show about the Cthulhu mythos. Look for our podcast near the old wishing well in the blasted heath, wherever you find your podcasts. We suggest Podbean or Apple Podcasts. Find us on the web at pgttcm.com and at Black Clock Audio on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and Black Clock Audio Tales on YouTube. Welcome to Black Clock Audio Tales. Check out our new website over at www.pgttcm.com. Edited by Daniel Spitzer, music by Kevin MacLeod. The Chamber, Oppressive Gloom, Despair. Welcome to Part 1, Folklore of Great Britain.
Join us at the end of the month when we talk about the Great Old Ones.
Chapter 16 of Welsh Fairy Tales. Recording by Betty B. Welsh Fairy Tales by William Elliot Griffiths. Chapter 16. King Arthur's Cave. In our time, every boy and girl knows about the nuts and blossoms, the twigs and the hedges, the roots and the leaf of the common hazel bush, and everybody has heard of the witch hazel. In old days, they made use of the forked branches of the hazel as a divining rod. With this, they believed that they could divine or find out the presence of treasures of gold and silver deep down in the earth and hidden from human eyes. And what boy or girl has never played the game and sung the ditty, "London Bridge is falling down, falling down, falling down," even though nobody now living ever saw it fall? Now, our story is about a hazel rod, a Welshman on London Bridge, treasures in a cave, and what happened because of these. It was in the days when London Bridge was not, as we see it today, a massive structure of stone and iron, able to bear up hundreds of cars, wagons, horses, and people, and lighted at night with electric bulbs. No, when this Welshman visited London, the bridge had a line of shops on both sides of the passageway and reaching from end to end. Taffy was the name of this fellow from Denbigh in Wales, and he was a drover. He had brought all the way from one of the richest of the Welsh provinces a great drove of black Welsh cattle, such as were in steady demand by Englishmen, who have always been lovers of roast beef. Escaping all the risks of cattle thieves, rustlers, and highwaymen, he had sold his beeves at a good price, so that his pockets were now fairly bulging out with gold coins, and yet this fellow wanted more. But first, before going home, he would see the sights of the great city, which then contained about 100,000 people. While he was handling some things in a shop to decide what he should take home to his wife, his 3 daughters, and his 2 little boys, he noticed a man looking intently, not at him, but at his stick. After a while, the stranger came up to him and asked him where he came from. Now, Taffy was not very refined in his manners, and he thought it none of the fellow's business. He was very surly and made reply in a gruff voice, "I come from my own country." The stranger did not get angry, but in a polite tone made answer, "Don't be offended at my question. Tell me where you cut that hazel stick, and I'll make it to your advantage, if you will take my advice." Even yet, Taffy was gruff and suspicious. "What business is it of yours, where I cut my hazel stick?" he answered. "Well, it may matter a good deal to you, if you will tell me, for if you remember the place and can lead me to it, I'll make you a rich man, for near that spot lies a great treasure." Taffy was not much of a thinker, apart from matters concerning cattle, and his brain worked slowly. He was sorely puzzled. Here was a wizard who could make him rich, and he did so love to jingle gold in his pockets. But then he was superstitious. He feared that this sorcerer derived all his uncanny knowledge from demons, and Taffy, being rather much of a sinner, feared these very much. Meanwhile, his new acquaintance kept on persuading him. Finally, Taffy yielded, and the two went on together to Wales. Now, in this country, there are many stones placed in position, showing they were not there by accident, but were reared by men, to mark some old battle or famous event. And for this, rough stonework, no country, unless it be Korea or China, is more famous than Wales. On reaching one called the Fortress Rock, Taffy pointed to an old hazel root and said to his companion, "There, from that stock, I cut my hazel stick. I am sure of it." The sorcerer looked at Taffy to read his face and to be certain that he was telling the truth. Then he said, "Bring shovels and we'll both dig." These having been brought, the two began to work until the perspiration stood out in drops on their foreheads. First the sod and rooty stuff, and then down around the gravelly mass below, they plied their digging tools. Taffy was not used to such toil, and his muscles were soon weary. But, urged on by visions of gold, he kept bravely at his task. At last, when ready to drop from fatigue, he heard his companion say, "We've struck it!" A few shovelfuls more laid bare a broad, flat stone. This they pried up, but it required all their strength to lift and stand it on edge. Just below they saw a flight of steps. They were slippery with wet, and they looked very old, as if worn ages ago by many feet passing up and down them. Taffy shrunk back, as a draught of the close, dead air struck his nostrils. "Come on, and don't be afraid. I'm going to make you rich," said the sorcerer. At this Taffy's eyes glistened, and he followed on down the steps without saying a word. At the bottom of the descent they entered a narrow passage and finally came to a door. "Now, I'll ask you, are you brave, and will you come in with me if I open this door?" By this time Taffy was so eager for treasure that he spoke up at once. "I'm not afraid. Open the door." The sorcerer gave a jerk and the door flew open. What a sight! There, in the faint red light, Taffy discerned a great cave. Lying on the floor were hundreds of armed men, but motionless and apparently sound asleep. Little spangles of light were reflected from swords, spears, round shields, and burnished helmets. All these seemed a very ancient pattern, but immediately in front of them was a bell. Taffy felt some curiosity to tap it. Would the sleeping host of men then rise up? Just then the sorcerer, speaking with a menacing gesture and in a harsh tone, said, "Do not touch that bell, or it's all up with us both." Moving carefully, so as not to trip or to stumble over the sleeping soldiers, they went on, and Taffy, stopping and looking up, beheld before him a great round table. Many warriors were sitting at it, their splendid gold inlaid armor, glittering helmets, and noble faces showed that they were no common men. Yet Taffy could see only a few of the faces, for all had their heads more or less bent down, as if sound asleep, though sword and spear were near at hand, ready to be grasped in a moment. Outshining all was a golden throne at the farther end of the table, and on it sat a king. He was of imposing stature and august presence. Upon his head was a crown, on which were inlaid or set precious stones. These shone by their own light, sending out rays so brilliant that they dazzled Taffy, who had never seen anything like them. The king held in his right hand a mighty sword. It had a history, and the name of it was Excalibur. In Arthur's hand it was almost part of his own soul. Its hilt and handle were of finely chased gold, richly studded with gems. Yet his head too was bent in deep sleep, as if only thunder could wake him. "Are they all, everyone, asleep?" asked Taffy. "Each and all," was the answer. When did they fall asleep? Asked the drover.
Over 1,000 years ago, answered the sorcerer.
Tell me who they are, and why here? Asked Taffy.
They are King Arthur's trusty warriors. They are waiting for the hour to come, when they shall rise up
and destroy the enemies of the Cymry,
and once again possess the whole island of Britain, as in the early stages, before the Saxons came.
And who are those sitting around the table? Asked Taffy.
The sorcerer seemed tired of answering questions, but he replied, giving the name of each knight, and also that of his father, as if he were a Welshman himself. But at this Taffy grew impatient, feeling as if a book of genealogy had been hurled at him. Most impolitely, he interrupted his companion and cried out, "And who is that on the throne?" The sorcerer looked as if he was vexed, and felt insulted, but he answered, "It's King Arthur himself, with Excalibur, his famous sword, in his hand." This was snapped out, as if the sorcerer was disgusted at the interruption of his genealogy, and he shut his mouth tight, as if he would answer no more questions for such an impolite fellow. Seizing Taffy by the hand, he led him into what was the storehouse of the cave. There lay heaps upon heaps of yellow gold. Both men stuffed their pockets, belt bags, and the inside of their clothes with all they could load in. "Now we had better get out, for it is time to go," said the sorcerer, and he led the way towards the cave door. But as Taffy passed back and along the hall where the host of warriors were sleeping, his curiosity got the better of him. He said to himself, "I must see this host awake. I'll touch that bell and find out whether the sorcerer spoke the truth." So, when he came to it, he struck the bell. In the twinkling of an eye, thousands of warriors sprang up, seized their armor, girded their swords, or seized their spears. All seemed eagerly awaiting the command to rush against the foe. The ground quaked with their tramping and shook with their tread, until Taffy thought the cave roof would fall in and bury them all. The air resounded with the rattle of arms as the men, when in ranks, marked time, ready for motion forward and out of the cave. But from the midst of the host, a deep-sounding voice, as earnest as if in hot temper, but as deliberate as if in caution against a false alarm, spoke. He inquired, "Who rang that bell? Has the day come?" The sorcerer, thoroughly frightened and trembling, answered, "No, the day has not come. Sleep on." Taffy, though dazzled by the increasing brilliancy of the light, had heard another deep voice, more commanding in its tones than even a king's, call out, "Arthur, awake! The bell has rung! The day is breaking! Awake, great King Arthur!" But even against such a voice, that of the sorcerer, now scared beyond measure, lest the king and his host should discover the cheat, and with his sword Excalibur chop the heads off both Taffy and himself, answered, "No, it is still night. Sleep on, Arthur the Great." Erect over all, his head aloft and crowned with jewels, as with stars, the king himself now spoke. "Know, my warriors, the day has not yet come, when the Black Eagle and the Golden Eagle will meet in war. Sleep on, loyal souls, the morning of Wales has not yet dawned." Then, like the gentle soughing of the evening breeze among forest trees, all sound died away, and in the snap of a finger, all were asleep again. Seizing the hand of Taffy, the sorcerer hurried him out of the cave, moved the stone back in its place, and motioning to Taffy to do the same, he quickly shoveled and kicked the loose dirt in the hole and stamped it down. When Taffy turned to look for him, he was gone, without even taking the trouble to call his dupe a fool. Wearied with his unwonted labors and excitements, Taffy walked home, got his supper, pondered on what he had seen, slept, and awoke in the morning refreshed. After breakfast, he sallied out again with pick and shovel. For months, Taffy dug over every square foot of the hill. Neglecting his business as cattleman, he spent all the money he had made in London, but he never found that entrance to the cave. He died a poor man, and all his children had to work hard to get their bread.
Chapter 17 of Welsh Fairy Tales. Chapter 17. The Lady of the Lake. One easily gets acquainted with the Welsh fairies, for nearly all the good ones are very fond of music. While they live down in the lakes or up in the mountains, they are always ready to help kind or polite people who treat them well or will give them a glass of milk or a saucer of flummery. But, oh, what tricks and mischief they do play on mean or stingy or grumpy folks with bad tempers. They tangle up the harnesses of the horses, milk the cows, letting the milk go to waste on the stable floor, tie knots in the tails, or keep the dog's mouth shut when the robbers come sneaking around. Better not offend a fairy, even though no higher than a thimble. A favorite place for the elfin ladies of the lake is high up in one of the freshwater mountain ponds. They are cousins to the mermaids that swim in salt water. They say that these lake maidens love to come up close to the shore to smell the sweet grass and flowers, which the cows like so much. Near one of these lakes dwelt a widow with only one son named Gwyn. One day he took his lunch of barley bread and cheese, and he went out, as usual, to tend the cows. Soon he saw, rising out of the water, to dress her long and luxuriant hair, the most beautiful lady he had ever seen. In her hair she held a golden comb and was using the bright lake surface as a mirror. At once Gwyn fell in love with her, and, like an unselfish lad, held out his refreshments, barley, bread, and cheese, all he had, bidding her to come and take. But though the lady glided towards him, while he still held out his hand, she shook her head, saying, "O thou of the hard-baked bread, it is not easy to catch me." Sorry enough to miss such a prize, he hurried home to tell his mother. She, wondering also whether fairies have teeth to chew, told him to take soft dough next time. Then, perhaps, the strange lady would come again. Not much sleep did the boy get that night, and before the sun was up, he was down by the lakeside, holding out his dough. There, hour after hour, neglecting the cows, he looked eagerly over the water, but nothing appeared except ripples started by the breeze. Again and again he gazed in hope, only to be disappointed. Meanwhile, he thought out a pretty speech to make to her, but he kept his dough and went hungry. It was late in the afternoon, when the trees on the hills were casting long shadows westward, that he gave up watching, for he supposed she would come no more. But just as he started to go back to his mother's cabin, he turned his head, and there was the same lady, looking more beautiful than ever. In a moment, he forgot every word he meant to say to her. His tongue seemed to leave him, and he only held out his hand with the dough in it. But the lake lady, shaking her head, only laughed and said, "Thou of the soft bread, I will not have thee." Though she dived under the water and left him sad and lonely, she smiled so sweetly as she vanished that, though again disappointed, he thought she would come again and she might yet accept his gift. His mother told him to try her with bread half-baked, that is, midway between hard crust and soft dough. So having packed his lunch, and much excited, though this time with bright hopes, Gwyn went to bed, though not to sleep. At dawn, he was up again, and out by the lakeside, with his half-baked bread in hand. It was a day of rain and shine, of sunburst and cloud, but no lady appeared. The long hours of watching and waiting sped on until it was nearly dark. When just about to turn homeward to ease his mother's anxiety, what should he see but some cows walking on the surface of the water? In a few minutes, the lady herself, lovelier than ever, rose up and moved towards the shore. Gwyn rushed out to meet her. With beseeching looks and holding the half-baked bread in his hand, this time, she graciously took the gift, placed her other hand in his, and he led her to the shore. Standing with her on land, he could not speak for many seconds. He noticed that she had sandals on her feet, and the one on her right foot was tied in a way rather unusual. Under her winsome smile, at last he regained the use of his tongue. Then he burst out. "Lady, I love you, more than all the world beside. Will you be my wife?" She did not seem at all willing at first, but love begets love. Finally yielding to his pleadings, she said, rather solemnly, "I will be your bride, but only on this condition, that if you strike me 3 times, without cause, I will leave your house, and you will only be to blame, and it will be forever." These words stuck in his mind, and he inwardly made a vow never to give his lovely wife cause to leave him. But not yet did happiness come, for even as he took the oath that he would rather cut off his own right hand than offend her, she darted away like an arrow, and, diving into the lake, disappeared. At this sudden blow to his hopes and joy, Gwyn was so sorely depressed as to wish to take his own life. Rushing up to the top of a rock, overhanging the deepest part of a lake, he was just about to leap into the water and drown himself when he heard a voice behind him saying, "Hold, rash lad, come here." He looked, and there down on the shore of the lake stood a grand-looking old man with a long white beard. On either side of him was a lovely maiden. These were his daughters. Trembling with fear, the lad slipped down from the rock and drew near. Then the old man spoke comfortably to him, though in a very cracked voice. "Mortal, do you wish to marry one of my daughters? Show me the one you love more than the other, and I will consent." Now the two maidens were so beautiful, yet so exactly alike, that Gwyn could not note any difference. As he looked, he began to wonder whether it had been a different lady, in each case that rose out of the water. He looked beyond the old man to see if there were a third lady. When he saw none more, he became more distracted. He feared lest he might choose the wrong one, who had not promised to love him. Almost in despair, he was about to run home, when he noticed that one of the maidens put forward her right foot. Then he saw that her sandal was tied in a way he had already wondered at. So he boldly went forward and took her by the hand. "This one is mine," said he to the father. "You are right," answered the old man. "This is my daughter, Nelfritch. Take her, and you shall have as many cattle, sheep, horses, hogs, and goats as she can count of each without drawing in her breath. But I warn you that 3 blows, without cause, will send her back to me." While the old man smiled and Gwyn renewed his vow, the new wife began to count by 5s. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. At the end of each count, drawing in a fresh breath, there rose up out of the lake as many sheep, cattle, goats, pigs, and horses as she had counted. So it had happened that the lad, who went out of his mother's cottage in the morning, a poor boy, came back to her, a rich man, and leading by the hand the loveliest creature on whom man or woman had ever looked upon. As for the old man and the other daughter, no one ever saw them again. Gwyn and his wife went out to a farm, which he bought, and oh, how happy they were. She was very kind to the poor. She had the gift of healing, knew all the herbs, which were good for medicine, and cured sick folk of their diseases. 3 times the cradle was filled, each time with a baby boy. 8 long and happy years followed. They loved each other so dearly, and were so happy together, that Gwyn's vow passed entirely out of his mind, and he thought of it no more. On the 7th birthday of the oldest boy, there was a wedding at some distance away, and the father and mother walked through the field where their horses were grazing. As it was too far for Lady Nelfritch to walk all the way, her husband went back to the house for saddle and bridle while she would catch the horse. "Please do, and bring me my gloves off the table." she called, as he turned towards the house. But when he returned to the field, he saw that she had not stirred. So before handing his wife her gloves, and pointing playfully to the horses, he gave her a little flick with the gloves. Instead of moving, instantly she heaved a deep sigh. Then looking up at him with sorrowful and reproachful eyes, she said, "Remember our vow, Gwyn. This is the first careless blow. May there never be another." Days and years passed away so happily that the husband and father never again had to recall the promise given to his wife and her father. But when they were invited to the christening of a baby, everyone was full of smiles and gaiety, except Nelfurch. Women, especially the older ones, often cry at a wedding, but why his wife should burst into tears puzzled Gwyn. Tapping her on the shoulder, he asked her the reason. "Because," said she, "this weak babe will be in pain and misery all of its days and die in agony. And, husband dear, you have once again struck me a careless blow. Oh, do be on your guard and not break your promise." From this time forth, Gwyn was on watch over himself, day and night, like a sentinel over whom hangs the sentence of death, should he fall asleep on duty. He was ever vigilant, lest he, in a moment of forgetfulness, might, by some slip of conduct, or in a moment of forgetfulness, strike his dear wife. The baby, whose life of pain and death of agony Nelfurch had foretold, soon passed away, for happily its life was short. Then she and her husband attended the last rites of sorrow, for Celtic folk always have a funeral and hold awake, even when a baby, only a span long, lies in the coffin. Yet in the most solemn moment of the services of burial, Nelfurch, the wife, laughed out, so long and with such merriment that everyone was startled. Her husband, mortified at such improper behavior, touched her gently, saying, "Hush, wife, why do you laugh?" "Because the babe is free from all pain, and you have thrice struck me. Farewell." Fleeing like a deer home to their farm, she called together, by its name, each and every one of their animals, from stable and field, yes, even those harnessed to the plow. Then over the mountain, all moved in procession to the lake. There they plunged in and vanished. No trace of them was left, except that made by the oxen drawing the plow, and which mark on the ground men still point at. Broken-hearted and mad with grief, Gwyn rushed into the lake and was seen no more. The three sons, grieving over their drowned father, spent their many days wandering along the lakeside, hoping once more to see one or both of their dear parents. Their love was rewarded. They never saw their father again, but one day their mother, Nelfurch, suddenly appeared out of the water, telling her children that her mission on earth was to relieve pain and misery. She took them to a point in the lake where many plants grew that were useful in medicine. There she often came and taught them the virtues of the roots, leaves, juices, and the various virtues of the herbs, and how to nurse the sick and heal those who had diseases. All three of Nelfurch's sons became physicians of fame and power. Their descendants, during many centuries, were renowned for their skill in easing pain and saving life. To this day, Physician's Point is shown to visitors as a famous spot, and in tradition is almost holy.